Welcome to Season 4 of the Lehigh Valley Arts Podcast, where we explore the local arts culture and community in the Lehigh Valley.
We'll be doing this through conversations with individual artists, administrators, musicians, poets, actors, and arts and cultural organizations. We'll discuss all types of mediums with the goal of enriching local arts culture. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Lehigh Valley Arts Podcast. My name is Ben, and this week, Elise will be interviewing Robin Gao. Robin Gao is a critically acclaimed trans poet from rural Pennsylvania. He is the author of several poetry collections, an essay collection, and middle grade and YA novels. Fair novels include Ode to My First Car, A Million Quiet Revolutions, and Dear Mothman. Faye works as a community educator, calling folks into discussion around queer and disability justice.
Robin, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am so excited that you're here and just like fangirling just a little bit because I don't know if I mentioned this here or not, but I was gifted your Dear Mothman book as a Christmas gift this year.
That's so sweet.
From my friends Ben and Elizabeth. And so I'm obsessed with Mothman. Like, it's a deep personal obsession. From where it stems, I don't remember, but quite fixated on Mothman. And I was in Rehoboth Beach for the Witch Festival in October, and I was at that big bookstore that's down there, and I saw your book, and everyone was like, Elise, look at this book. Oh, my God, check out this book. And I almost bought it, and then I was like, I don't know. And I ended up buying, there's like this little Mothman children's book, and my coworker just had a baby, so I was like, I'm going to buy that so I can like share it with them. And then I had met you at my job somewhere in between that, and then I was gifted this book. And I didn't connect all the pieces till I looked you up on Instagram, but I was like, oh my God, there's someone else in the Lehigh Valley with a Mothman obsession.
That's amazing.
It just made me so happy. So I'm so glad you're here. Your book is incredible, as I'm sure all of your other work is. But I'm so glad that I get to meet you and we just get to sit down and chat.
Yeah, I'm excited. Even if we just talk about Mothman. Like,
well, maybe that could be like, we could have like a whole segment about just Mothman somewhere.
I would love that. I was also at that witch festival.
Really?
In Rehoboth.
No way.
Yeah. It's a small world.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have like this fabulous Mothman pin that someone lent me, and I was digging through my drawers today. Just like, I'm gonna wear it tonight, and I couldn't find it. I was so upset. So it's okay. But what was the thing I was thinking about too earlier? Is I went there's at least one other Mothman fan in the area, because I went out in my Mothman Halloween costume this year, and I ran into a woman that was also dressed as Mothman.
That's great.
It's very exciting. So. For those listening, can you just give us like a little like what the fuck is Mothman?
So Mothman is like doesn't actually really look that much like a moth, but kind of like a very tall, legend says that he's like 9 foot, 10 foot tall, very, very big, like winged creature, typically all black with glowing red eyes. The origin story of Mothman comes from Point Pleasant, West Virginia, where like he was spotted like supposedly like chasing some car, but subsequently after that there's been all sorts of other like Mothman sightings, and I feel like it's also like there's like a renaissance of Mothman right now. Like, I feel like there's like a sub community who's like obsessed with Mothman, and I think that he also like means a lot to like the queer community. And like whenever I start to like explain why, I'm like, okay, this is a little bit complicated, but like, but hear me out. I just think that for queer folks, like cryptids in general is like this idea of like being real but not totally seen, images of like monstrosity because of the ways queer people are demonized. It's definitely, at least for me, something I gravitate towards. Mm-hmm. Like, as a little kid, I loved horror movies, monster books, anything like scary. And like, I think that was my surrogate representation because, well, I mean, like, villains are queer coded. Mm-hmm. Most monsters or something, they're usually doing some kind of like gender bending or something like that. So I think that they were like my earliest like things that I related to. And I think that I've just continued that as an adult. There's a lot of ways in which I like don't really grow up, but that's why I write books for kids.
That's fair. So I'll just ask the obvious question. How did you get into writing and decide that you were going to be an author?
It's so interesting because I've like wanted to be a writer since I was like very, very small. I actually didn't like really write or read very well. I had like a few like learning disabilities. And so I used to just like make basically like comic books to tell stories like as very, very little. But I would always tell my teachers and stuff like, I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to be an author. And I had a short period of being like, I might be a film director. And then that was like too hard. So I was like, not for me. I really enjoy the way that being a writer, you can like work on everything like from anywhere, like in the corner of a room, like you can always be writing. It never really felt like an option for me. Like it's just kind of like my go-to self. I feel like I'm a storyteller and I have always written more formally. I went to graduate school for creative writing and I think that that kind of made me more into the like air quote like professional writer realm, but people have so many different pathways to like being a published author. And I think that people are writers even if they don't publish stuff. Long convoluted story to say like that's kind of how I've just like always been doing it and probably always will. I just like enjoy it for myself and so like it's just kind of a plus that other people like it. And like, you know, I do try to think about like readership and stuff. I'm not just like, this is just for me. But, you know, I would write weird stuff even if like nobody was reading it.
I think that's the beauty of like making your own art is that it is a representation of you.
And yeah, for
if
sure.
other people like it, like, cool. And I don't know. It's such a weird line because we talk about that a lot. Like on this show, it's a concept that comes up a lot about like your day job or like your full-time job or whatever. And then you're making art on the side and this balance between like, do you do it as a living or do you do it as something just for you? And yeah. like everyone has totally different answers and all are completely valid. And it's like, I feel like there's a sweet spot when you're like, oh, I make this and it represents me and people like it. Like, that's super cool.
Yeah, and it can be a little bit hard to find that. I definitely have felt that, especially like because now I publish books that are like large market books. So like Mothman and like my YA books and my book that's coming out in May. It's a larger readership. You have to think a little bit more about a wide variety of opinions that I wouldn't think about because I write poetry for adults. And so like that is like what I want it to be. I don't really care. But I feel like there's kind of like a little bit more of like a responsibility you have if you're like writing for and in solidarity with youth. I have to think more about like, is this a message that I want to be sending? For my, like, personal poetry that's, like, for an adult audience, that is just me being weird. That's not, like, I'm not as worried about, like, messaging. I mean, I want it to be, like, thoughtful, but I'm not, like, as intensely focused. But then there's the other level of trying to make it still marketable. I hate that we live in, like, a capitalist world that limits a lot of creativity because I think that, like, the best books that I've always loved are ones that are, like, strange and doing something experimental and oftentimes when you're selling books, people aren't going to always go for that, the weirder stuff. but those have always been like my favorite books.
So when you say like messaging in terms of young adult books versus your kind of like poetry that's more for adult audiences, are you referencing or thinking kind of about these adults that read your poetry or hear your poetry have like ideally fully formed adult opinions and brains and they aren't so influenced by like individual opinions or like what's kind of this like idea of messaging that you think about when you're writing for young adult audiences?
I think when I'm writing for like young people, I think that the one responsibility I feel like I have is that the books like skew towards hope. And I feel like that's like the only really guiding force is that I feel like if I'm writing towards young folks, most young people like live much a long time after they're reading this. And like I want people to, even if like things are hard or like characters face struggles, like I want there to be like a leaning towards positive, especially because there's so much like pain in the queer community. And like a lot of my books like balance those things. And it's totally valid that some stories are just sad. For me, I like really want there to be that balance and for there to be like things that people can latch on to. And I think for adults, like I don't always feel like I have to give people hope. Because sometimes as humans, we feel hopeless. And like, I think like a adult poetry collections, like my books for youth carry like a narrative and my adult poetry doesn't. It's usually just like collections of poems that speak to each other. And so for that, I think I permit myself to have space to explore some of the more like darker or sadder themes without the same like impetus towards like I said, like towards hope or towards something forward.
So, and you can answer this like not from what society reads it as, but like you personally, how do you differentiate between like poet and author, or do you, or is it all one thing?
It's really difficult because I really don't feel like what I do is totally different in the like adult sphere and the like children's sphere. I feel like genres are not super helpful. I actually struggle sometimes with marketing books because there are stories told in poems, and people are like inherently scared of poems in general. They're like, oh my God, I don't know how to read poetry. And that always makes me be like, just read this. It'll be okay. Like, it's going to be fine. And so I don't see genre that much. Mm. And I kind of just think of it as like different tools for exploring a similar idea. Cause I think I explore similar themes in like all the different ways that I write. Cause sure. I write prose too, and I also write nonfiction sometimes. So it's kind of just like approaching a similar question with a different like tool set is kind of like how I think about it.
As a young person, can you think back to like maybe a first project or like a first passion like story or something that you wrote that you kind of like feel either really motivated by or attached to? Like a lot of people that come on the show will say, oh, I did this mural in my third grade class, or
yeah,
I had a horrible experience with an art teacher and that pushed me into doing this, or et cetera, et cetera.
There was a poetry club at my high school, which was also kind of like a makeshift GSA because sure. like we actually weren't allowed to have a GSA because they made it into like the anti-bullying club. They're like, you can't have a GSA, but you can have anti-bullying club, which is like, there's a lot to unpack there. So we had the poetry club, and I watched and read a lot of like slam poetry, and that like really made me feel motivated to write poetry. And I grew up in Kutztown. There used to be Bieber buses that would go to New York. There's a Bowery Poetry Club, which is like actually a pretty well-known poetry club, but they had an open mic. And I was like, I'm going to go to that. And I like read poetry there, and I felt like just really amazing about it. But I think that being able to read poetry with like my peers, like really was like the first time I felt like proud of things. And I was like, wow, I have some poems I'm like really proud of. And other than that, I wrote like a novel when I was in like senior year of high school, and one of my teachers like actually read parts of it, which now looking back, I'm like, bold of me to give a 300-page novel to a teacher, like as if she has time to like read my novel. But it was very strange. It was about like creatures that like make dreams and somebody getting trapped in a dream. And I don't think it was too bad. I mean, I have no idea where it exists now, you know, like who knows, like on what hard drive or like if it exists at all, that story. But I felt very proud of it at the time. And I think that it was significant for me because I finished something large. I always like tell people when they ask me like tips about writing, it doesn't matter how bad the first draft is, but like if you don't write the first draft, you can't fix it. So like you gotta just like get through it. And so I think like going through that process of writing something, even though I didn't edit it, like I think that that was very like formative for me.
A lot of people I talk to, and even myself, like I hid my artwork for so many years from people because it was about things I was struggling with or things that I just needed to get out somehow and didn't know how else to get out. And like, that's awesome though, that you just kind of were like, here, no, read it. I want you to read it.
I think that like, interestingly enough, like something that like my uncle like was very part of our family, and like something I remember him saying to me, like he's an artist, so he like is a painter. Something like he said to me is like, it doesn't matter if you're good, it just matters if you keep telling people about it and keep doing it, which is like actually really true, because there's like some, and I'm not like gonna name like any like large authors, but there's some authors that just like pump out novels, and like they keep talking about themselves, they keep doing the thing, and like it sucks to have to market yourself, like it feels gross and weird, but like I think that like him telling me that, it's also very permission giving though, to like be like, you don't have to be perfect, you just have to keep doing it. I think that that's actually not like the worst advice. That's like pretty good advice.
Okay, you have this work of art that you've created. How does it get from point A to point B to point C?
Oh my gosh. So for like trade publishing, like the bigger publishers, it's such a process. Mm-hmm. Like I started querying, so like sending like queries to agents in like the summer of 2019 for A Million Quiet Revolutions, which is like my first YA novel. I had a really lucky go of finding an agent, because some people query for years. Mm. Some people query for like 4 or 5 years trying to find an agent, because agents really only want to take something if they're like passionate about it too, because they're going to have to do so much work on it. So like people could even be good writers and they're just not landing with somebody who's like, I want to champion this story, essentially. Mm-hmm.
Is query, that's a term for like the period of time that you're looking for?
Yeah, and like a query letter would be like, I have this book. Here's attached to the first 10 pages. Okay. Would you represent me, essentially? Or would you – basically, usually you send, like, the first 10 pages, and they'll write, like, I want to read the whole thing. I only had two people ever ask to read the whole, like, first one of my novels, and one person ended up – my agent, who's still my agent today, she was like, I like this novel, but you have to, like, change the setting because A Million Quiet Revolutions – is set, well, like, the characters are exploring the American Revolution as, like, part of their plot, but it was originally set as a as, like, World War One. And she was like, nobody knows about World War One. You can't, you gotta, like, try a different setting, which I agree with. I just find World War One a little bit more fascinating for me personally, but, you know, readership. She told me if I rewrote it that she would consider representing me, so I rewrote the whole book, and then she signed me to be like her client, and then from there we did edits together, and then from there we've like pitched to different publishing houses, essentially probably to like 30 publishing houses. And mostly get no's, and then a few people ended up like putting in bids, and then they have a like an auction, and so like the different editors will compete with bids, and that's why you want multiple editors to be interested, because then you can drive up like your advance price. So they bid on it, and then somebody got it. And I ended up getting, like, a two-book deal. And so, like, I worked with that editor for two books. And then I had a whole other process similar to that for Dear Mothman. And I ended up with a at a different publishing house. And then once you're at that publishing house – I know this is long, but, like, once you're at that publishing house and you edit the whole book, usually, like, the editor sends you, like, a few letters based on, like, what she wants to draw out, work on, stuff like that. And I think some of my favorite parts of that process are, like, also – talking about, like, cover idea designs. It feels really cool to be, like, what do you imagine? And then I've been lucky that they've always asked my input on, like, artists who work on my book and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And then it goes into the world. But it takes forever because, like, you've written the book. Like, this came – Dear Mothman came out in 2023, and I wrote it in 2020, which is actually a really, really quick turnaround for a book. But – mostly, usually, it'd probably be like 4 years from like writing a book to like it coming out, I would say.
That's generally longer than I would have thought.
Unless you're like Stephen King, who like, bumps out a novel every year. And they're like, not bad. So like, I'm not knocking him. But like, I think for most people, some people get on a schedule where they're doing like a novel a year. But usually there's like a delay between like when it comes out and like when they've actually written it.
So it's just – and say I'm wrong if I'm wrong, but it sounds like generally it's been a pretty positive experience with like the people that you've worked with so far.
Definitely.
That's good.
I've been so lucky.
Do you feel like the first book that you spoke about asking for a full rewrite is like, that's like a big deal. And I think I was curious, like if you've run into situations where like you really have to grapple with like saving something that you, I'm sure I know the answer, but like grappling with saving something that you wrote or like being willing to adapt it a little bit to kind of meet that wider spread audience.
Yeah, I think that for the most part, I've been pretty like open. The feedback that people have given, nobody's ever said anything that I was like, no way. Like I think in Dear Mothman, there used to be like another kiss between Noah and Hannah. And they were like, for a middle grade audience, characters don't generally kiss that much. And I was like, when I was in middle school, everybody was kissing. I think that that's the one thing that's really confused me about mainstream publishing is like their guideposts aren't like how kids actually act. It's like it's how like the gatekeepers, and gatekeepers is like a term that people usually use to talk about like librarians, teachers. It's not necessarily negative, but they're the people who usually get books to trickle down into people's hands. It's how they perceive the material. And so it sometimes frustrates me because I'm like, kids want things that represent their experiences. But I didn't really care because that's like, it wasn't important to the plot. It wasn't important to things like that. And like, I feel like mostly when I, like, express to my editors, like, oh, the reason why I'm doing this is because X, Y, and Z, they usually let me. I think the most more in-depth conversation I had is, like, in A Million Quiet Revolutions, there is, like, a pretty, like, clear and depicted sex scene. Mm-hmm. And basically the conversation is, like, this can't be in book fairs. Like, this mm-hmm. won't be, it won't reach all these things. They never told me I can't. A lot of times my, like, agent and editors really function on, like, a, if you do this, this will happen. If you do this, just, like, giving me yeah. the information I need. And for me, I felt like it was really important for there to be a clear sex scene, because, like, I've never seen a sex scene between two trans men. Mm. Like, one that was, like, positive and, like, mirrored, like, really, like, in active and consent. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think that, like, people need representations of, yeah, like, right. healthy sex encounters mm-hmm. because teenagers, you know, have sex. And I'm not, like, bashing, like, TV shows and stuff, but, like, a lot of TV shows, like, you know, for the interest of it being interesting and having conflict, like, have a lot of, like, really unhealthy relationships. Mm. And, like, I was like, I want this healthy relationship to have, like, a healthy sex scene so people can, like, be like, wow, that was, like, positive to read. Like, nobody's traumatized from this experience. Like, that sounds great. Yeah. And so, like, I felt it was really important to include it. But I know for a fact that, like, there's teachers who don't want to teach it because they're, like, uncomfortable with, which sure. I'm like,
yep.
come on. But anyway, I think that that's probably one of the larger decisions that I've had. But,
And so it did end up in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, awesome. Totally. I'm usually, I think in all of my experiences, I've like mostly kept the thing that we like yeah. talked about, except unless it's like something that's like, if it doesn't impact the story or the themes that much, mm-hmm. I'm usually just happy to like trust other people's judgment, because like my editor has worked on hundreds of books, like mm-hmm. if she says we don't need to say this, we don't need to say it. Mm-hmm. You know,
I like that, makes me happy to hear, because I think in my brain, just based on what I consume in media, like that there's like some big conglomerate that's anti this or anti that, that's like pulling out parts of a story that really need to be told. And I'm yeah. very happy. Like it feels good to hear that like you've had a positive experience.
Yeah, I would say book publishing is pretty progressive with the stories mm. and stuff. I usually tell people like the biggest barrier for, I think, a lot of, not all marginalized authors, I don't mm. want to like make a broad generalization, but for a lot is like getting the publisher to invest a little bit more in like marketing and mm. sales and stuff, because the sales that you make with your book determine if you can get another book deal and determine if you can keep publishing. And that's really difficult, because being marginalized, people already view your story as like people think of my books as like just for trans people mm. or just for like, I don't know, like, so one of my books is about a bisexual girl. So just for that identity, which is so strange, because like, we don't think of like books about straight people right, as just for straight people. Yeah. Like, I've enjoyed a few straight books, like, you know? So, like, we don't think about them like that. And I think mm-hmm. the same is true for, like, if you talk about other intersections, like, oftentimes, like, folks by people of color, like, white folks will be like, oh, that's not for me. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously not true, because it is a story and it has value to everyone. But I think sometimes there's a struggle with that, because also publishers want to make sure to like highlight the like diverse intersections of books, mm-hmm. but at the same time sometimes it ends up being like marketing in very small silos, mm-hmm. and I think that like that's one of my biggest struggles, is like I think that at this point in my writing career I'm like okay with like not being like mega best-selling author but like you know, when you have your first book come out, like I think that I felt a little bit sad mm-hmm. because there just wasn't as much of a budget for like marketing. Mm-hmm. I didn't get to travel with my first book. I was really lucky to travel with Dear Mothman a little bit, but you know, some of that stuff is hard. And also sometimes the editors are bound by that market, right? Like mm-hmm. there's things that like also can't happen for me. Like I can't sell my book to a lot of places overseas, because like if it's a country where like LGBT stuff is like really bad, like mm-hmm. they're less likely to buy it. And even places that are about on par, and you know, the United States is not
right
great
sure.
either. So like, you know, I was gonna say a lot of places even like on par with the US in terms mm-hmm. of like LGBTQ plus treatment, like might be less likely to buy a queer book because less market, you know, all that sure. kind of stuff. So
that's interesting. I hadn't even like thought about that I don't know, like people that read is already like its own market that seems kind of smaller
sure.
but then yeah. like people that there are assumptions about before the book even hits the shelves, there are so many assumptions about like who will pick up this book just based on their interest or identity. When like, personally, I feel in a lot of cases like I'll pick up anything and like whatever.
Oh, same. That's like my methodology. I'm like, this looks like it has a cool cover. Yeah. Like, that's great.
It's the cover.
No, for sure. Really, though. If it's got cool art, like I'll probably pick it up. It's also probably because I like mostly use the library. So like, you know, I didn't buy it. I'll try it.
Right.
Yeah.
So how has your experience been with like cover art and illustrations and like the visual side of your books?
I've been like really lucky to work with like a lot of queer artists on some like really beautiful covers. Usually they send like a few mock-ups of like ideas, and for the most part, everybody's always gone with the one that I liked. So that made me feel great. It's cool because I also like keep up with the folks who've done art in my books. Like I follow them on Instagram and sometimes we'll message about where the books have gone. And it's cool because a lot of them are like smaller artist creators who do all kinds of different projects. My first cover was a really just cool process because the person who did it also is a poet too. And so I really have loved their poetry and like reading that after they did my cover. Like I said, I feel really lucky. People always compliment the covers. I'm like, had nothing to do with me, but it is really fabulous.
It is an important tool. Like,
totally. I mean, it's the first thing people see.
Yeah.
It conveys a tone. It's so important. You almost have even a little bit more say sometimes in the like adult poetry book covers, because usually that's like some like your idea, because poetry presses are generally smaller. So for a lot of those, I've like been like, I like this artist. Can we like ask them for this piece? And they'll be like, sure, you know.
Yeah, I was most curious about that because poetry in general is so abstract. Like, how do you communicate to people like, oh, I want this to be the cover of my poetry book when maybe there's 30 different poems about 30 different things?
Yeah, I think most poets will like pick an artist that they feel like represents the vibe of the book. I guess some people might do like a self-portrait or something like that, but I think that generally like most are like a something of an artist that they like. And I like keep little on my like Instagram, I have like a little save folder of like, I like these artists. If ever one day I have a better budget, like I'm going to ask to use this for my book cover.
So speaking of your poetry work, I'm a visual artist and like I've never spent that much time reading poetry. And even just over the last couple months, like I've started to get really fascinated and interested in it. And one of the things that really interests me about poetry and poets is like this crossover between it can be something that's very private or it can be something that's like really performance based.
Yeah, definitely. Totally.
Where do you feel like your poetry and your like involvement in a poetry community like falls in that?
It's so interesting because I used to like read a lot. Like I think that like my biggest like learning has really come from like, so there is this club at my undergrad that was called LitSoc, which stands for Literary Society. And we would meet every week and people would just bring stuff to read. People snapped for things. And like, then there is always like a feedback portion. And I think I just learned so much from like testing out things by reading them to a room full of people. I didn't like appreciate at the time like what a valuable resource that is, because like who has a group of people who meets every week to read their work? Like that's why. I mean, that can only really happen on like a college campus because of the close-knitness of it. But anyway, recently it's been like a little bit more intimate, like private, because I just haven't read aloud that much. I'm getting back out into it. Lehigh Valley has a really beautiful poetry scene. There's so many cool stuff. There's like Poetry as Promised, the Noble Quills, who reads out of the Barnes & Noble basement poetry, these really beautiful, awesome, flourishing poetry spaces. And I'm trying to get back into it. I did a reading. I was like one of the featured readers for Poetry as Promised at Nowhere Coffee, and it was really fun. And so I'm getting back into reading again. I think for the last few years, I've mostly read aloud from my like children's work, but I'm trying to get back into the like sharing aloud sphere. I don't think that there's really that much different. Like, I'm like a very open book. Like, my poetry can be very like confessional or intimate, and it doesn't really like bother me. I think like going through the process of like coming out as trans in a time where it's a little bit less well known, like I'm desensitized to like any like and also like I've been submitting poetry places for like I guess since like probably like 2015. And so like rejection does not bother me. Like I don't care if people don't resonate with it. Like, I like it as long as I'm not like doing something harmful. Like, I would care if somebody said like that thing you said is offensive. Like, I care about that. Other than that, like, I'm not really like, I listen to feedback and I'm happy to like share things.
Mm. That's something I personally miss a lot too, like from that college campus experience, yeah. is talking to other people about your artwork and like yeah. constructive criticism and review. And like, it's hard to find that.
Yeah.
At all.
It's because it's like we got thrown into like these like trying to survive capitalism kind of lives. And I do definitely miss that a lot. I think that having a space, like I said, like, I don't think I thoroughly appreciated like having an artistic community to like, and I, like I said, though, I think that people are building that here. It does exist outside of colleges, but it was really great when I had that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are there like poets that you really enjoy or like people that people whose work you really, really enjoy reading?
It's so hard when someone asks that. Right. Because like, I have like a million poets. I think that some of my like go-to poets, I love C.A. Conrad. Mm. They grew up like kind of locally and they are like one of the strangest humans I've ever met. They do a lot of things called like somatic poetry rituals where they do like a very in-depth ritual and then like write a poem afterwards.
Whoa.
I went to like a workshop that they ran at like the LGBT Center in New York City, and it was like the weirdest poetry workshop I've ever had. And like, they talked a lot about how at one point in their life, they felt like they were just like pumping out work and they felt like a factory. And they were like, I have to destroy the factory in myself. And they started doing these like rituals and they're fascinating and strange. Like one example is like they like wanted to like eat a storm. And so they went out into a giant storm and like had bread and like let the storm like rain all over the bread and then we're eating it. And like that's like the least strange.
Sure, sure.
I really recommend their work.
Huh.
They're really awesome. They're a kind human too.
That's always a good
Yeah,
choice.
Definitely. I think as far as like other poets that have impacted me, my thesis advisor for grad school, her name is Jacqueline Jones Laban, and her book Last Scene is like persona poetry of like missing children. Mm. And it is like haunting and fascinating. And I've always really connected with her work. And then the last one I'll name is and this is all in like the adult poetry sphere. I can't even get into the YA stuff because I'll keep going forever. But I really love the work of Joss Charles. She's a trans poet, and her book Field is like medieval language in like a modern context, all about like embodiment and gender and stuff like that. And it's very, very strange. And it's like very much like language poetry in that like you could read a word and it kind of has double meanings. And I like read that book like over and over. I think it's just like so fascinating. Mm. Yeah.
That's awesome. Ben was editing an episode that we recorded a couple months ago with Larry Mason, who's a local actor and like really, really outspoken disability advocate and like writes a lot of his work centered around disability advocacy and like disabled experience. And him and I work together a lot just on like reviewing his work or like reviewing each other's work, which I really appreciate because that's something that's hard to find.
Totally.
And one of the things that came up in his interview, and I don't even know if it'll make it in the actual recording of it, is like seeing your own work as advocacy and like where is the line with that? Because I think in marginalized communities, there's such an expectation from people outside of those communities that like you have to explain yourself or you have to explain or that like your work should serve as an advocacy tool for people in that community. And that's one, a very heavy weight to bear.
For sure.
But two, like when it comes to that line between like things in your work that are points of advocacy or points of representation or things that are really intentional, like how do you see that kind of intertwined with the poetry and the young adult novels and all of that stuff?
That's a really great question. And I think it's something that I've definitely struggled with. And I'm like, I think in my earlier books, I was more apt to want to explain. And like recently I've been like, I don't really want to like talk about, I want, if you're in on it, you're in on it. If you're not, you're on not. And maybe like, and I also don't think that people like, I think especially like, maybe not especially, but it's really common for like queer identities for people to be like, explain that to me, or like, I just don't understand, mm-hmm. or stuff like that. And sometimes my response more recently has been kind of been like, it's okay to not understand everybody's experience. Like, you should still like trust that it's real. Like, why is this experience like, and I think that that's true for other marginalized communities too. People like feeling like they deserve access to like understanding like trauma, or, I mean, in most interviews for places, the first thing that somebody asks me is like when I knew I was trans, which is like incredibly strange to me, because like it will be for like a public organization who talks about writers. Like, it's not for like Out magazine or something. If it was a queer publication, like, sure, like we're talking about being gay, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But like, it's for not queer related things. And like, I'm also happy to have that conversation. It's just like, that's not what my book's about. It's definitely really hard. And I think recently, like I said, I'm trying to move away from like doing the explaining, but it's hard, because then we go back to that conversation around like how people pick up and read that book, mm-hmm. because educators do like books to be tools in some ways, especially when we're talking about youth books. So like, if they can't serve that purpose, it also limits your readership. And at the same time, like, you don't want to spend your whole time like explaining these experiences. And I really tried to be adamant against that. Like, one of the notes that I didn't take from an editor about Dear Mothman is that they were kind of prompting me to have like the ending be kind of like a coming out scene. And I was like, I think that it is, but I don't think it should be explicitly. Like, they kind of wanted, kind of pushing towards being like, having Noah be like, and I'm like a boy and like stuff like that. And I was like, that's not how Noah would talk about himself. Mm. And I also think that like, it, like, that's also really important to me, is like preserving like the integrity of like real conversations and stuff. Because kids also know when you're like preaching to them. And I think that that's something that like kid lit in general like needs to have a bigger conversation about, is like so many writers or like adults who are like, it's my job to like educate kids. And I don't view my role as that. I view my role as like writing in solidarity with youth, because like they know things that I don't know. I know things that they don't know. Like, we're both humans. Like, sure, I've lived maybe a little bit longer, but like, I don't think it's my job to like educate them on, I don't know, said issue. I think it's my job to like represent scenarios that are like helpful or like can like represent people's experiences. But that's such a topic that I could talk about forever.
Sure.
Because it's really difficult as a marginalized author. I like to write messier characters. Mm. And there's always this pressure of like, if I write like a trans character who's mean, like people put pressure on you to be like, that's problematic, or like, you know, and or they're like, it's not a great representation. And the problem is that like marginalized people, like, we're people. And so like, we do crappy things to each other. We are selfish sometimes. Like, mm-hmm. it's hard to have those deeper, more nuanced conversations when like there's all this pressure on like the representation you provide. Mm-hmm. And I think especially for queer folks, also to have like your identity be really consumable. That's always been hard for me. And I've moved away from it myself, even in like my personal life, and saying like, I don't have like a perfect air quote like trans narrative. Like, I don't think I always knew I was trans. I think that gender is incredibly fluid. It's different across culture and across time. I don't think that it matters that much, but it does, because it impacts every way we move in our lives. So there's this like, but anyway, so as to say, is like, it's such a weight. And I don't have a good answer. So that's my thoughts.
That's okay. Again, that often comes up on the show where I'm just like, I'm just going to say something and I want you to react to it, because I think like that is the end point of it, is that like there isn't an end point to it.
It's like, going to be my whole career.
Like, yeah, you know? Exactly. Like, art, I think personally, like, art in all forms is advocacy, but like when you get to that point where you're having to explain yourself or defend like your identity in the art that you're making, is like, it's such a weird experience in line. And yeah, I had this whole idea and I wasn't sure how to like explore it, about like writer stereotypes and like things that people think writers do, or like picture writers or authors to be. And I was curious, like, I wanted to ask you about your writing space and like your writing setup and your process and kind of like what that looks like for you. Cause I think I saw like a TikTok or something the other day. It was like, I'm an author. Of course I do this, 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 or this. And I was like, I wonder if that's true for all people that are authors. Like if everyone, like this person was saying they like hermit in their basement and write this or do this or that. And you had said earlier about, like, I like that I can work from anywhere or do this. And so, I was just kind of curious about like your writing process and what that looks like for you.
I've written a poem every day since like 2017. Mm-hmm. So like I have a very, like every morning I get up, I write like an intro poem and then I work on my different projects for probably like 2 or 3 hours. And I play like ambient music, which is like a strange playlist on Spotify because it like drives out everything. But I just sit at like a table. I don't have like a elaborate setup or anything. I don't feel like I need one. I can write anywhere as long as I have coffee and a table and my laptop. That was my next question.
Coffee, tea, water.
Coffee. I drink a lot of coffee. I think I got like supremely addicted when I had an internship at like a major publishing house and it was really cool. I was very broke and they had like a free coffee bar. And I drank like – I was drinking maybe like 6 or 7 cups of coffee because I was like, this is great. And then I was like, wow, I have like a sustained addiction. But anyway, like I've tapered myself down now and I like drink a reasonable 2 cups of coffee. But that's what I do. Yeah. It's nothing really like fancy. The other thing that I do is that I take notes throughout my day. So I have like a little note card. I take notes on things that I think are strange or interesting.
Yeah, that's a good – I was thinking in my head, I was like, yeah, like a sketchbook.
Basically, it's like writing sketchbook.
Yeah. That's awesome. Cool. So in all of your writing, what are some things that you're really excited about that are coming up or things that you're working on, and share as much or as little as you'd like?
So I have a book that's coming out in May called Gooseberry, and it's my first book in prose. I'm really excited about that because I think that I felt – I don't know, self-conscious that I haven't had a book in prose and I'm like, will I be able to do it? But I did it. And it's fine. It's about a young non-binary kid who is in the foster care system and has been bounced around a lot. And at a fair, they meet this like really wild dog named Gooseberry who is like terribly behaved. And they decide like, because they want to be a dog trainer, they're like, I'm going to get Gooseberry. And they end up being placed at a house with like a queer couple, and the queer couple lets them get Gooseberry, and they have a lot of adventures. And basically their goal is to try to train Gooseberry to be like a therapy dog. And you'll have to read it to see everything else that happens. But I'm really excited about it. It was a really fun project. I actually had like a local young poet, who had his own experiences in the foster care system be like an authenticity reader on it. So it was really cool to get to work with somebody else too locally. I think it's going to be exciting. I'm going to bring my dogs to some of the readings. I don't have anything scheduled yet, but I'm really excited about the book. And then in terms of like stuff that I'm writing, I have another book in the works that I can't talk about totally yet. But in terms of ones that are in like draft format, I'm working on a project with my partner, which is cool. I've never co-written a book. But we're co-writing a book about like basically like feral queer teenagers who like go into the woods and like meet a monster that's called the Every Beast, and it can like shapeshift between different monsters. And they, you know, basically unite together to expose like abuse that's happening in the church that they're part of. And someone will have to read it to know what happens. But it was really a healing process and like cool because my partner and I both just had like hard experiences growing up, and so I think it was really about like capturing and being kind to like younger versions of ourselves. And also kind of like exploring the idea of like, what if I met you when I was like 14? And so it was really like it was a fun process. I say was, we're like almost done. So that's been a really fun project, and I'm always working on other like YA and middle grade books. Another middle grade book that I have in like very early draft form is about basically like a stowaway trans boy going out to sea because he wants to basically live as himself. It's set in the like 1700s, and the ship gets rerouted into the Sea of Monsters. And so him and the crew basically have to survive sea monsters and stuff. So those are just some projects. And then other than that, I also I run my own small business with my partner. So our small business, and we do all kinds of stuff. We do like basically like any kind of diversity, equity, and inclusion kind of trainings, and then all kinds of like arts related stuff. And I'm really excited about those projects. I'm trying to think of a good example of that kind of thing. Like I do poetry workshops. He teaches about like ecology and environmental education, foraging, watercolor, all kinds of stuff. Oh, cool. And so doing that kind of work together has been really exciting. So, yeah.
That's awesome. Is there anything like over the last couple of months that you've done that you were like, you left and you were like, oh, that felt so good. Or like, oh, like whether you attended or like something that you got to table at or
totally
for or whatever.
So me and my partner are like diversity and artistic consultants on a play going on at Muhlenberg College.
Oh, cool.
And it's called The Haunting at Hartfield Hall. And it was actually written by someone who was my intern at a former job.
Oh my gosh.
And it's a trans like ghost story. And it's so, so cool. And we got to do like a half day workshop where we talked about queer themes and we did like some poetry exercises with the cast. And it was just wonderful because so many of the people in the cast are queer, telling like a queer ghost story. And the play itself is beautiful and brilliant. Mm-hmm. And it's just really exciting to like be part of something like that and get to work with their cast. It's going to be really great. It's the play itself goes up at the end of February, early March. So it's coming up really soon. But yeah, that was something that I mean, I don't have any role in like, I'm not acting in it. I didn't
sure,
write it,
yeah.
But it was really beautiful to be part of that experience. And I'm like grateful to be able to help them realize everything they want to.
That's awesome. And so I was curious like what the connection was, but you said that it was someone that you had worked with. Is that how they found you so that you could work in this capacity, or
their director found me?
Oh, cool.
Because I've worked on a few different things before for different local colleges and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing like DEI training for about 10 years now, so like mm-hmm. I've been around that sphere. We just connected, and the director is really great. He was very adamant about like wanting to make sure that he did it right, because he's not part of the community. And he's like, I really want people involved to make sure it's done right. And he really has done a really great job.
That's incredible.
Really beautiful. Yeah.
Cool. How fun. I like that a lot. I'm definitely going to go check that out.
Oh, it's so fun. It's we last week we got to see like the first half performed, and I was blown away. Like I thought the script was great, but I didn't get to see it like staged. The stage is even better, obviously, but yeah.
So you spoke a little bit about your partner. Did the two of you, you said you have this kind of consulting business together? Cool.
And we do art too. So like, it's basically like art and consulting.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And are you kind of from the Lehigh Valley area, or did you move here?
Yeah, I'm from Kutztown, so
yeah.
Berks. But
yeah. Extended Lehigh Valley area.
it's kind of, because Kutztown's like, I mean, it's halfway between Allentown and Reading, so mm-hmm. it's kind of like, you can go either direction.
Yeah.
I actually grew up more like in like doing things in the Reading area,
mm-hmm.
But I always have been around Allentown. I moved to New York for graduate school, and then I moved to Carbon County, which was interesting. I love the folks of Jim Thorpe, but it was really hard to like build community. It was just a difficult sphere.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of really supportive people, and there's a lot of like very not supportive people.
Sure.
And I didn't totally like feel safe. And then I got a job in the Lehigh Valley, and I moved here with a friend and really started to build a community. And now I've been here since 2020.
Mm.
And yeah, I love living here. I know it's small, and like, you know, we can make all of our jokes about the Lehigh Valley.
Sure, yeah, right.
but I really do. I think that there's like a lot of really beautiful things here, and I enjoy since I've lived in like New York City area, mm-hmm. like I know that I can't live in a big city. I like the like more manageable city.
Mm.
That was not for me. It was very big, very expensive. I mean, it was fun, but you know. So that's my tie to Lehigh Valley.
Yeah, cool. And thank you earlier for like mentioning like community and these poetry groups that you enjoy being part of, because I think that's always like something I like about our show is I learn a lot from people about like the communities that they operate in and like things that they enjoy. And I think people listening, hopefully They're like, oh, that's exactly what I was looking for. Like, oh, definitely. I was looking for something like that. So we'll make sure to like tag all of those groups in,
totally.
Our, in your episode too.
I feel like it's so important too to like everybody share stuff like that because sometimes I think in like certain pockets of like the Lehigh Valley, people will be like, we don't have any of this. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that people are doing so much cool like niche work all mm-hmm. across the valley. I mean, it's really just about like connecting or finding folks because sometimes it's hard to find those spaces, but they exist and people are building them and it's really mm-hmm. beautiful. Yeah.
So Robin, if people are interested in finding your work online, finding your books, finding your poetry, finding about what you're up to next, where can they find that?
I'm on Instagram and TikTok at Robin and Twitter or whatever they're calling it now at Robin Gal Poet. And I do a lot of like TikToks. It's like my favorite social media because I just like to be goofy and strange. So I recommend it even if you haven't done TikTok yet, like it's very fun. And then I just have like, my website is just robingao.com. My partner and I also run an Etsy page. Mm. He's more in charge of that because he's the more artist side of things. but we work on it together. So it's a collaborative project. And that's Wanderin' Wild is the Etsy page. So if you want to check out, we make all kinds of like beaded earrings, art prints, all kinds of strange stuff. So check it out. Yeah.
Awesome. Very cool. And that's spelled R-O-B-I-N and then the last name G-O-W at Robin Gao Poet. Robin, thank you so, so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Robin, thank you so much for coming on today's episode. Our opportunity of the week is for the Fine Arts and Curiosities Craft Show and Vendor Market hosted by Arcana Antiques and Oddities. That is going on Saturday, March 9th of 2024 from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. This is a craft show and vendor market dedicated to showcasing fine art, oddities, and the metaphysical.
Thanks for tuning in to the Lehigh Valley Arts Podcast. Don't forget to like the podcast, leave us a review, and follow us on both social media and streaming services at Lehigh Valley Arts Podcast.